Imagine you just defeated a flesh-eating ice dragon. Like you survived by the absolute skin of your teeth, only to realize that your hardest battle isn't actually behind you.
Oh yeah, it's just beginning.
Right. No, your hardest battle is going to be negotiating municipal plumbing and dodging a really bad engagement.
It's the ultimate bait and switch, you know? I mean, you gear up for this epic fantasy saga, and suddenly you are entirely bogged down in administrative bureaucracy.
Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're opening up a fascinating stack of transcripts from a group of interactive fantasy storytellers operating in the fictional world of Mirari.
Yeah, and the lore here is just incredibly dense.
It really is. And our mission for you today is to explore how this specific group takes traditional, self-serious, high fantasy tropes and just completely turns them inside out.
Which is so refreshing.
Exactly. Because instead of relying on, pure combat to save the day, these heroes solve epic problems with elaborate political cons, mundane infrastructure negotiations, and honestly, a massive dose of improvisational comedy.
Which is exactly what makes these transcripts so compelling. I mean, we aren't looking at a polished, rigidly outlined novel here. We're looking at chat logs from a text-based collaborative role-play session.
Okay, let's unpack this right out of the gate because I want to make sure we're all on the same page. When we say collaborative text-based role play, what does that actually look like in practice?
Think of it like a massive, ongoing improvisational writing exercise.
Right.
So a group of people log into a shared digital space, and each person controls a single character.
Okay, so no main author.
Right, exactly. One person writes a paragraph describing what their character does or says, hits send, and then the next person has to instantly react to that prompt.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it operates entirely like a live jazz performance. One player might suddenly switch the tempo from a heroic battle to a comedic beat, and the rest of the band just has to instantly improvise to keep the song from falling apart.
I love that jazz analogy because the tempo shifts we see in these source materials are enough to give you whiplash.
Oh, absolutely.
Whether you're an aspiring writer trying to construct better narratives, or a tabletop gamer, or just someone who appreciates a clever puzzle, there's a masterclass here in how to balance epic life or death stakes with deeply relatable human or, well, goblin comedy.
Yeah, to set the scene properly, we're following a highly eclectic party of adventurers. We have Hannah, who's a fey warrior, Line, an elder 10-foot-tall snowcat.
They're massive.
Right. Then there's Rosie, a highly excitable doglin, Sam, an opportunistic minstrel, and Alesia, the legendary bandit queen.
Just a quick pause, Doglin, because I consider myself pretty well-versed in fantasy lore, but I don't think I've ever seen that in a bestiary.
You haven't, and that really highlights the beauty of this medium. A doglin is just a quirky homebrew mashup of dog and a goblin.
That's hilarious.
It is. It's a perfect example of the player's do-it-yourself approach to world building. They aren't constrained by traditional publishing rules. If a player wants to be a loyal, slightly grubby dog-goblin hybrid, they just, write it into existence.
And that DIY spirit is exactly what gets them into trouble. So when our story picks up, this eclectic group has just survived a harrowing escape from a mountain fortress filled with flesh-devouring demons.
Very dark stuff.
Very dark. They managed to defeat an ice dragon, which is an incredible feat, but they're totally battered. They're resting in the decaying ruins of an old City Ice's lair, actually.
Yeah, and the physical toll is real. Hannah, the Fey warrior, is nursing severely bandaged hands.
Right, because to defeat the dragon, she wielded an iron warhammer to shatter the beast's life crystal.
And in this lore, iron is highly toxic to Fey creatures.
Exactly. She literally poisoned and burned her own hands to save her friends.
It's a moment of profound, classic high fantasy sacrifice. The stakes are established as incredibly severe right there.
Right, but the moment they're safe, the narrative completely shifts away from this noble sacrifice and turns into basically a bizarre hostage negotiation.
Yep, the tonal whiplash.
They have a half-fey, half-goblin prince named Feasel traveling with them, and Feasel is absolutely refusing to return home to his goblin fiancee, Princess Griselda of the town of Greedle.
And this is where the storytellers begin deconstructing the hero's journey. I mean, usually the lost prince reclaiming his rightful throne is the entire point of a fantasy epic.
Right. Think about Aragorn in Lord of the Rings.
Exactly. It's framed as this glorious, undeniable destiny. But Feasel treats it like a threat.
He actively hates the idea of being king.
He really does. He complains that being in charge just means hearing endless whining from his subjects.
Yeah, he says the taxes are too high, the roads are terrible, the pigs are too clean. which is amazing. And my personal favorite, his subjects complain that their feet don't have enough fungus.
Which is such a brilliant pragmatic subversion.
Yeah.
For Feasel, ascending to the throne doesn't mean glory. It means miserable middle management.
Wait, so they defeated an ice dragon, but the real final boss is getting out of a bad engagement.
Pretty much.
Think about the last time you were at work, and management offered you a promotion that sounded prestigious, but really just came with a mountain of headaches, endless complaints from your team, and a negligible pay bump.
You'd run the other way.
You'd look for any excuse to decline it. Feasel would literally rather wander the dangerous wilderness than deal with HR complaints about foot fungus. But wait, I have to challenge this narrative choice for a second.
Okay, go for it.
They just had a life or death battle with an ice dragon, and now we're talking about foot fungus and bad engagements. Doesn't this completely undercut the heroic victory they just earned?
It does undercut the traditional hero narrative, sure, but that's entirely intentional. By introducing such a mundane, bureaucratic problem right after a life or death struggle, the authors are grounding the fantasy.
Grounding it how?
Well, it reminds the audience that surviving a dragon is great, but life still goes on. You still have to deal with your annoying relatives.
That's so true. So the group has to strategize. How do they get Feasel out of this marriage without starting a massive war with the Goblin Kingdom?
And the brainstorming session that follows is just pure chaos.
Oh, it's amazing. Rosie the Doglin, who the transcripts explicitly note has a very distinct wet dog smell, suggests framing Feasel's disappearance as a tragic accident.
Yeah, and she also casually throws out the idea of giving Princess Griselda a personality transplant.
Which is a rather bold medical procedure for a medieval fantasy setting.
Very avant-garde.
Yeah.
What's fascinating here is how the players navigate this conflict. They don't resort to swords or fireballs to solve the problem. They choose psychology.
Right. Hannah and Alesia craft a highly complex political ton. Alesia, the bandit queen, who is secretly related to Feasel, agrees to claim him as her own romantic conquest and challenge Princess Griselda to a duel.
They're weaponizing reputation.
Exactly. Because Alesia is a living legend in this world, and they know Griselda is aggressively headstrong. Like, the chat logs mention that Griselda once split a heavy wooden table with her forehead.
You can't just send a polite letter to a person like that.
No. You need a spectacle so intimidating that she'll surrender without throwing a single punch.
But to pull off the ultimate con, they need magic, a massive magical illusion. And to fuel a spell of that magnitude, they need the frozen claw of the ice dragon they just defeated.
Which leads them to their next crucial mission before they can confront the goblins defrosting a knight.
Right. So the party travels through the freezing mountains until they find a towering ice statue of Sir Tristan, an ancient fey knight, and his noble steed, Sohate.
And Hannah uses the ice dragon's dew claw to meticulously cut them free from this magical ice block. The tension builds beautifully here. She cuts him out, but he's freezing, barely conscious.
The players are setting up the ultimate quintessential fairy tale trope.
True love's kiss to warm the frozen night.
Yes. It's the absolute pinnacle of romantic high fantasy. The transcript shows Tristan whispering that he thought he would never feel warmth again. Hannah is crying, tears slipping down her face. It's incredibly vulnerable.
But the storytellers refuse to let the moment remain purely serious. Right as Hannah leans in for this mythic, life-saving kiss, Sam the minstrel decides this is the perfect time to compose a meta ballad. He starts singing out loud, narrating the kiss as it happens, completely ruining the romantic tension.
And then Feasel, the goblin prince, decides he wants to see what all the fuss is about regarding this kissing magic. So he leans over and awkwardly kisses Rosie the Doglin just to see what happens.
Which is a huge mistake.
It's a perfect example of how interactive storytelling works on a psychological level, though. When a scene gets uncomfortably sincere or vulnerable, players often use meta-humor as a defense mechanism.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, they feel the tension rising, and someone instinctively throws the comedic wrench into the gears to relieve the pressure.
And it works entirely. Feasel instantly regrets the kiss, complains about the taste, and demands a mint.
A mint.
And Rosie is so grossed out, she falls backward onto her tail, then runs over and kisses Sam the minstrel just to pass on Feasel's cooties. It is utter bedlam.
And that bedlam continues right into the setting for their recovery. The group retreats to a place called the Sacred Grove of Sassaprilla.
Which is just an amazing concept. It's a magical hot spring where giant ancient tree altars actually pour root beer from stone taps.
So cozy.
Very cozy. They're eating roasted rabbit, rehydrating dried carrots and gravy, and splashing around in the warm water while drinking root beer. But here's where it gets really interesting and where I struggle a bit with the narrative choices.
Okay, why?
They just pulled off a legendary rescue of a knight who was trapped in ice for a century. Then they instantly transitioned to what is essentially a tailgate party with root beer on tap. Doesn't this jarring shift lower the narrative stakes?
It's a valid question.
Doesn't it break immersion?
You'd think so, but if we connect this to the bigger picture and examine the mechanics of pacing, it actually does the exact opposite. Constant, unrelenting, epic tension is exhausting.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
It exhausts the audience, and it definitely exhausts the players writing the story. When everything is life or death, the concept of life loses its texture. These cozy moments actually anchor the high fantasy. This tailgate party gives the characters and the writers room to process their trauma.
How so? Can you give me an example from the logs?
Absolutely. While the Doglin is splashing around trying to wash the wet dog smell out of her clothes, Line, the giant snow cat, initiates a deeply poignant conversation with the newly defrosted Tristan.
Right. They talk about Line's adoptive father.
Lord Thomas, yes. Mm-hmm. Tristan respects Thomas as a mythic hero who saved his lands, but admits he doesn't really like him as a person.
And Lion defends his father, but not by boasting about his military victories. Lion humanizes this legendary figure by revealing his hidden griefs.
Exactly.
He explains how Thomas lost his own parents, how his fiancée was killed in a dwarven raid, and how he uses arrogant bravado as a shield because he always feels like an outsider.
So right in the middle of this wacky root beer hot spring, we get an incredibly nuanced breakdown of post-traumatic stress disorder and survivor's guilt in a fantasy hero. The players are negotiating narrative control in real time.
One player introduces the comedic root beer taps.
And another player balances it by introducing a profound discussion on grief.
I see what you mean. By putting the epic and the mundane side by side, both elements feel much more authentic. You care about them saving the world because you see how much they enjoy just sitting by a fire processing their feelings.
Exactly.
Okay, so they're rested, Tristan is defrosted, and they are finally ready to execute the great Goblin Con of Greedle.
This is the climax of the entire transcript. The group sneaks up to the edge of the goblin town. They split their forces. Hannah, Tristan, Sam, and Line hide behind some large boulders to watch the show.
Right, and Elugia, the bandit queen, takes the dragon's claw and steps out to cast her spell. And what a spell it is. She doesn't just conjure a small parlor trick.
Not at all.
The transcripts describe a deafening roar. The wind picks up, bending the trees backward. A massive shadow of bat-like wings passes over the hiding group. Elysia creates a fully realized, terrifying, city-sized magical illusion of a white dragon, and she rides it straight into the center of town.
The goblin reaction is exactly what you'd expect from a town facing a mythical apocalypse. Just pure, unadulterated chaos.
Mules are fainting like dominoes. One goblin runs headfirst into a tree and knocks himself out cold.
I love that part.
And a dozen goblins try to cram themselves into a single outhouse to hide until the entire structure just tips over backward into the mud.
So gross, but so funny.
The dragon lands, roaring, and Elysia just sits there on its neck, looking completely bored, waiting for the princess to arrive.
Now, this is where a traditional story would have the princess cowering in fear, begging for mercy, or maybe bravely drawing a tiny sword to defend her honor.
Right.
But Griselda emerges from her palace, and she isn't terrified at all. She is entirely entrepreneurial.
Yes. She walks out, looks up at this legendary bandit queen riding a massive nightmare beast, and her first questions are you here to abduct me? And if not, how much do you want for the dragon?
And when Elysia explains that the dragon isn't for sale, Griselda gets offended and asks if the beast chats out statues of her, demanding she be given one.
It's like showing up to a tense hostage negotiation with a tank, and the other person just wants to know if the tank gets good gas mileage. It completely shatters the intimidation tactic. Elysia has to practically sigh, drop the menacing act, and explain that she is there to claim Fiesel as her romantic conquest, and Griselda needs to hand him over.
And this brings us back to the brilliant subversion of the middle management theme. Griselda's reaction to losing her fiancé isn't heartbreak. It's sheer annoyance about civic infrastructure.
She wants compensation.
Yes. She demands to know what her compensation will be, because Fiesel is the only person in town who understands how the municipal toilets work.
The pragmatism is just staggering. She's staring down the gaping maw of a dragon and worrying about plumbing. She argues that a kingdom requires a king to function like. She says it's right there in the word kingdom. And she cannot marry her royal mules because they won't produce an heir.
So practical.
So Elysia offers to have the Golden Hawks, a mercenary group, send down some moderately priced plumbers, which is an amazing sentence to read in a fantasy setting.
Truly.
But Griselda still needs a husband to run the town. And that is when the town's naked shaman steps forward.
We should probably emphasize that the transcripts go out of their way to note that this shaman is completely naked and exceedingly wrinkly.
He pushes through the panicked crowd, totally nude, and declares that he should be king because he wields the power of soap.
The power of soap.
He claims he can get any goblin to do what he wants simply by waving a bar of soap at them. And if that isn't enough of a political platform, he wiggles his eyebrows and offers Griselda his special warming massage oil's toad flavor.
And Griselda, who is initially repulsed by him, is suddenly intrigued by the sheer utility of the offer.
Right, he's got soap and oil, problem solved.
The crisis is completely averted. The bandit queen gets to keep Fiesel, and the goblin princess gets a naked shaman with toad-flavored massage oil to fix her plumbing.
It's the perfect, ridiculous resolution to an absurd standoff. But what I find truly brilliant here is the dual narrative happening simultaneously behind the rocks.
While the town square is going crazy.
Exactly. While this bizarre political resolution is playing out, the rest of the party is watching from their hiding spot. And Hannah and Tristan, the Fey warrior and the newly defrosted knight, are crammed close together in the shadows.
And amidst the screaming goblins and the fainting mules, Tristan finally drops his formal, protective, knightly bravado. He admits he's been a coward about his feelings and tells Hannah plainly that he intends to court her.
And Hannah cuts right through the formality. She pulls him in and kisses him. She whispers, "I love you," 3 times, just to make sure there are absolutely no misunderstandings.
It's so sweet.
It really is. It's this incredibly sincere, quiet, romantic moment happening in the direct shadow of a fake roaring dragon and a screaming naked goblin.
And sitting right next to them, Sam the minstrel is frantically scribbling on a piece of parchment. He surveys the scene and decides that reality is entirely too messy to be inspirational. So he begins writing 2 very different versions of the event.
He writes the official version for the history books, where a young, clean-shaven, heroic shaman bravely steps forward to battle the evil bandit queen and save his slender, beautiful princess.
And then he writes the secret version, titled Ye Secret and Most Hilarious History of Greedle, which details the actual truth of the fainting mules, the toilet negotiations, and the toad oil.
Sam understands a fundamental truth about storytelling, you know. The heroic ballad gets you prestige among the nobles, but the comedy gets you free drinks at the local tavern.
Absolutely.
So what does this all mean? We've gone from epic dragon battles to avoiding middle management, from magical hot springs exploring PTSD to goblin plumbing negotiations. What is the ultimate takeaway from this deep dive for you, the listener?
Well, the true magic of this source material isn't the complex spells or the ice dragons or the magical artifacts. It's the improvisational creativity of the players behind the keyboards.
A human element.
Exactly. These storytellers deeply understand that epic narratives are actually the most engaging when the characters react with relatable, pragmatic, and highly imperfect human instincts. When you allow a character to care more about municipal plumbing than a glowing magical throne, you create a world that feels incredibly lived in, textured, and real.
I think that's such a valuable lesson for all of us, even outside the realm of creative writing. Whether you're navigating an overwhelming, chaotic project at work, or dealing with complicated family dynamics, or trying to construct your own personal narrative, there is immense value in leaning into the absurd.
For sure.
You don't always need to be the stoic knight holding the magical sword. Sometimes the best way to solve a massive, terrifying problem is with a really good bluff, a willingness to look completely ridiculous, and a deep appreciation for the fact that real life is always going to be messy. Sometimes you just have to ride your fake dragon into town and see what happens.
And this raises an important question for you to think about, something to mull over long after we wrap up here today.
Oh, I like where this is going.
If Sam the Minstrel's official, sanitized, highly heroic ballad becomes the accepted history of this fantasy world-like, the version that future generations of elves and knights read in their textbooks, how much of our own real-world history might just be a polished-up version of a chaotic, absurd goblin con that just happened to work out in the end?
Oh, wow. I will never look at a history textbook or a self-serious Renaissance painting the exact same way again, just a bunch of people trying to figure out the plumbing while pretending it was destiny.